Hey, have you heard about our Kickstarter campaign? Over at CineFantastique, we want to do a new weekly video interview show bringing you up close and personal with the stars and makers of science fiction, fantasy, and horror film. Show's going to be called Inside the Fantastique. It's what we do best at CineFantastique, and we need your help to make it possible. So please go to our Kickstarter campaign and give us your pledge. And to show you our thanks, we've got lots of groovy rewards for you. You can be an executive producer with an on-screen credit, or you can get a t-shirt with a crazy glow-in-the-dark CineFantastique logo, or we've got another t-shirt with art exclusively designed by famed cartoonist Bill Plimpton, or you can even get hard-to-find back issues. Or you can be an executive producer reading a hard-to-find back issue while wearing a Bill Plimpton t-shirt over your glow-in-the-dark t-shirt for a striking backlight effect. How am I doing, Andrea?
You're doing much better, Dan.
Okay, Andrea is my marketing expert. I'm seriously learning a lot from her. In any case, if you want to pledge, you can go to the page for this episode of Temple of Bad over at MightyMoviePodcast.com or at CFQOnline.com. We'll have the links to the Kickstarter campaign there. Or you can just go to Kickstarter.com and do a search on CineFantastique. It's that easy. Help us do this. It's going to be fantastic. And in advance, thank you very much. Okay, on to the show. We have a few questions for the people who made Blackenstein.
Okay, I don't know why I'm bothering to correct the fact checker for Blackenstein, but you really don't know what the Nobel Peace Prize is, do you?
If this film is called Blackenstein, the Black Frankenstein, why is there A, nobody named Frankenstein in the film, and why is Dr. Stein, as close as we get, white?
Why did you give us so many questions if you weren't going to answer them?
At any point, did you ever stop, look at the guy telling the story about the talking dog, and said, maybe we should be making the movie about him? Those questions and many more may or may not be answered on this episode of Mighty Movies Temple of Bad. Welcome to the Temple of Bad, the show where we talk about films so awful, it's practically a religious experience. I'm Dan Persons.
I'm Andrea Lipinski.
I'm Kevin Lauderdale.
And I'm Arif Al-Hadi.
And let me point out that all the films we discuss on Temple of Bad are available on Netflix, so you can watch along, and we suggest you do, because it'll help you pass the time while you're waiting for the Obamacare site to get back to you. Topical.
Wow.
Speaking of topical, this episode we're talking about Blackenstein, or as the opening titles helpfully elaborate, Blackenstein, the Black Frankenstein. Because I wasn't sure, you know, it could just have been some guy named Blackenstein. You never know. Or as it's also known in this household, Blackenstein, Sam Arkoff can't be blamed for this one. You know, right about this time, Sam Arkoff of American International Pictures was doing a buttload of blaxploitation films. And actually, one of the films he did was a film called Blackula, and was a big hit. He was planning on following it up with another film called Blackenstein. But wouldn't you know it, there was this guy, Frank Seletri, and he said, hey, good idea, and apparently gathered some people together in his garage, and he shot this before Arkoff ever got the chance. And by the way, Frank Seletri, this was his only credit, as well as his only writing and special effects credit. So the guy was a triple threat in every sense of the word. By the way, the director, William A. Levy, made his debut with this and went on to a fruitful career with such films as Slumber Party 57, shot in 1976, the classic film Happy Hooker Goes to Washington, and my favorite title of the bunch, Wham Bam Thank You Spaceman. I'm not sure what that is. But I'm betting that an astronaut helmet and a negligee figure in it somehow. So are
you saying that was a step up or a step down or a lateral move?
I think it was at the very least a lateral move for him. By the way, this film was my choice. And basically, as I explained in our previous show, I was really bummed out that we were never able to do the thing with two heads, the blaxploitation film where Ray Milland and Rosie Grier shared a body. Not well, but they shared it anyway. So, you know, I feel we have felt the lack for not covering a blaxploitation film on this show. And when this came up on Netflix, I said, this looks worthwhile. And I started watching it, and quite frankly, didn't take very long for me to decide, this is the one we got to do. But what really did sell it was there is this one moment near the beginning of the film where the female lead, Winifred, is introducing her disabled boyfriend to her boss, Dr. Stein. And by way of introduction, she says, "Dr. Stein just won the Nobel Peace Prize for solving the DNA genetic code." And I said, "Hello! I didn't know that was possible." There are so many things wrong with that sentence. So that sold it for me. And here we are, and I think we all can agree that this was worth the trip. So
worth an acid trip.
Yeah.
Not much more of a trip than that.
You definitely needed some sort of chemical enhancement for this film, because clearly everybody was on chemical enhancements when they made the film. So, before we do anything, let's get a listen to the trailer. This is a trip. Check this out. Here is the trailer for Blackenstein.
Dr. Stein would like to see you in his laboratory.
Brings you to California?
Well, I just arrived from New York. My fiance was wounded in Vietnam, and the doctors there wrote and told me he was being transferred to the Veterans Hospital here. He was seriously wounded when a landmine went off under him. Eddie, this is Dr. Stein, the doctor I studied with when I was in school.
Now, tell me once again, Eddie, what do you feel?
That was my middle finger.
That's correct.
Dr. Stein, look at this.
Blackenstein! The Black Frankenstein, come to the stand!
Okay, so here's the plot. Now, we all know the tale of Frankenstein, the doctor who played God by trying to create life and suffered for his hubris. That's a great story, isn't it, guys?
And it's an awesome story.
Classic. Well, fuck that. This isn't what this is about. In this story, Dr. Winifred Walker, played by Ivory Stone, has moved to Los Angeles to be with her boyfriend, Eddie, played by Joe DeSue, in a moving performance, by which we mean you can see him occasionally moving. Eddie's lost use of his limbs from a mine blast in Vietnam.
He's lost the actual limbs.
Well, that raises a few interesting questions. We'll get to that in a sec. We'll bring that up in a sec, because that does raise some interesting continuity issues there. But in any case, there was a bomb blast in Vietnam. He either completely lost his limbs or at very least lost use of his limbs. Fortunately, Winifred is also working for the Nobel Peace Prize winning geneticist Dr. Stein, played by the handsome John Hart. And, well, you know, frankly, it isn't clear that this was actually in her plans. The film starts out with what looks like her paying social call on Dr. Stein. But anyway, she winds up working over there at the Stein Clinic for confining a couple of people to bed. And good-hearted Dr. Stein takes charge of Eddie's treatment using DNA to restore his limbs. Except that the doctor's assistant, or butler, or something, Malcolm, who, according to IMDb, that name is spelled with a silent B. Weirdly, it's spelled M-A-L-C-B-O-M. He lusts after Winifred and switches the DNA systems, serums, and so Eddie mutates into a hideous monster and wanders out night after night seeking revenge, which boils down to killing white people fucking. This apparently is where the blaxploitation wrinkle gets in somehow. You know, Hawk, I'm of two minds about this film. On the one hand, this film feels like a dry run. It's like everybody got involved with it and they all said, well, you know, let's just sort of go at half speed on this and get used to this equipment. And then the next time we'll do something actually good. On the other hand, this is the sort of thing where everything is so wrong and so off, and it only gets weirder and more inept as it goes on, that it, for me, it actually started to become kind of frightening. You know, I was watching it, and I was beginning to fear that maybe my conception of normality is all wrong. You know, I'm watching and I'm going, there's no way you could let this happen. You can't let that go on in a film. You know, you can't let that slide there. And yet, here it is. It's made its way onto the screen and onto video. And by the way, in the Netflix version at the beginning of the film, there's an actual video glitch. So apparently, even over at Netflix, everybody said, yep, that's fine. Let's put it on Netflix. How did it work for you, Hawk?
Well, you know, Screenwriting 101 says that in the first 10, 15 minutes of the movie, you have to have the catalyst. In the about the 20-25 minute mark, you have to have the life-changing moment. And about the 60 minute mark, you have to have the point of no return. And then at that point, you go all the way into the climax. None of that happens in this movie. Not a lick. And as a result, it just feels off. And when I say off, I mean awful. It's there is no narrative flow in any way, shape, or form. Things just kind of randomly flow. It is, well, whatever. You know, it's got that, well, whatever feel. It's like, we're making a movie. Hey! Wow. There's so much to say that my brain is going, well, you could say this, you could say this, you could say this, and it's just overloading. Let's start with a basic thing here. Dr. Winifred Walker shows up to see her mentor, a geneticist who won the Nobel Peace Prize for decoding DNA, right? She's a physicist. She's a physicist. He's decoded DNA and won the Nobel Peace Prize for it. And somehow they're using all of this to restore a man's limbs. Science can do anything. And so can scientists. Because all you are is a scientist. You're not, you know, you don't have to have any specialty. Oh, medical degree. Not needed in any way, shape, or form, apparently. And I could go on and on, but I'm going to let somebody else give their thoughts. Okay.
By the way, I wasn't sure that I had heard that. I got halfway through the film and I said, wait a minute, didn't she say she was a physicist?
She got her PhD in physics. That makes her a physicist.
It's like that kid show that they had on years ago. I have my degree in science.
Yeah, I have my degree in psychology. I'm a fireman.
Andrea, how'd it work for you?
Well, I was not of two minds about this movie. I was kind of at about zero minds for this movie. Because the first half of it, I'm mostly going, okay, why am I watching this? And what's going to happen? And why am I watching this? I mean, the first half of it was really just abysmally slow. I mean, talk about, you know, waiting for plot developments to happen and talk about waiting for conflict. I mean, other than the hilarious line about the Nobel Peace Prize, I was just paying more attention to, like, okay, this is really, 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 really not as good as Blackula. That was kind of my prevailing thought. And then you wait and you wait and you wait and you wait. And then I don't, you know, just the writing was very lackluster. The acting was very lackluster. A bunch of the people were all like acting as though they'd just been dosed with an ether rag. And then even the writing was just obtuse. They'd be like, well, you know, the doctor says to her, you say he's been wounded. What seems to be the problem? She says, well, I'd really rather not say right now. Why? Why? Is that supposed to build tension? How's the doctor supposed to know what to bring with him to the hospital? Is he supposed to bring a stethoscope? Is he supposed to bring a straitjacket? Is he supposed to bring duct tape? How is he supposed to know what to bring? And it's like there were just sort of things that were happening that were kind of subtle. Like the stuff that was supposed to be big plot points, like the doctor's assistant is falling in love with Winifred. That's a major plot point. But that's acted so slowly and so gradually and with so little energy that I barely realized it was happening. But then other things would happen that I would think, oh, I've seen movies before, so I know that when this happens, you know, they'll make a reference to something, and I'll go, aha, okay, so you tell us that there's this patient, and she has to be injected with something every 12 hours, and if she doesn't get her injection within 24 hours, she will go from her present condition, and she'll age back to her 90s all of a sudden, and I'm like, great. You set that up. That is the Chekhov's gun of DNA injections. And I spend the whole movie waiting for that payoff. I spend the whole movie waiting for her to suddenly age to age 90 all in front of my eyes. And that doesn't happen. And they set up a bunch of things that I was like, oh, okay. And now I know this will happen by the end of the movie. But it didn't. So I don't know if that means that the writing was just lackluster, or they just left those scenes on the cutting room floor, or they said, oh, whatever, we can't afford it, or whatever. But, you know, there were too many things distracting me throughout the whole movie, like the music, or lack thereof, which is something we can explore further later. But I have lots of issues with the music. But I'm going to say that we spent a lot of time waiting for Blackenstein, the monster, to show up. Blackenstein, the monster, shows up, and I go, great. And I hit pause on my remote from my Roku box, and it said 43 minutes. It said, you're 43 minutes in, and there are 43 minutes left in the movie. I'm like, I had to wait halfway through the movie before the actual monster appears. And then, yeah, I don't know, the monster and the monster attacks and whatever. And for what it's worth, the monster does attack both white people and black people. So, I mean, he's kind of equal opportunity, if not the best monster. But
yeah, more. I think it's more weighted towards white people, though, at least in the beginning. I think he sort of balances it out towards the end.
Dan, he kills white people. He kills black people. He kills a dog. He plays with people's intestines. He's got a lot of issues.
By the way, you know, in terms of Chekhov's gun, you forgot about Bruno's tiger leg.
You know, it was hard for me to forget about Bruno's tiger leg. I mean, look, I have you asked ahead of time, were there issues that I wanted that we wanted to discuss about this movie? And I had two things in all caps. One of those was the music in this movie, and one of those was the science in this movie. So we can have further discussions on both the music and the science. Okay. And I can contribute to both of those things.
We'll delve into that a little further in a few minutes. Kevin, how about you?
Well, I think, first of all, the reason he starts off killing white people is because most of this film takes place in Beverly Hills. For something that was billed as a blaxploitation film, it significantly fails to hit almost all of the blaxploitation demands of the genre, I like to call them. Some people say cliches. After the title card, Blackenstein, the Black Frankula, Frankula.
I like that.
Name it. Copyright Kevin Lauderdale. Blackenstein, the Black Frankenstein. After that, there is one reference to race in this film. That takes place in part of a two-line joke, which is in a nightclub scene, which seems to have been edited in from an entirely different movie. If you're going to have a blaxploitation film, you have to have at least a discussion of race, if not race conflict. It has to take place in an urban setting. This film almost exclusively doesn't. Our character has to be relatable. Poor Winifred Walker, Dr. Winifred Walker, is, as we say, a physicist. And that's not really something anybody can relate to. I mean, she's not our entree into this universe. Contrast her with, say, Pam Grier, who's a nurse in at least one of her films, Coffee. That's something we can relate to. And most importantly, this film lacks the single prime requirement for any blaxploitation film. In my opinion, it does not have a kick-butt hero or heroine. Our monster lurches around. People ineffectively try to defeat him. Is he good? Is he bad? In the end, he's done in by dogs. What does that say?
Well, you know, Kevin, you did forget about Lieutenant Jackson, the cool lieutenant who's down with the law but can really rap with the kids.
Nice fro, too.
Yes.
Excellent hair on that man.
Yeah.
You know, Hawk, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about the black background of blaxploitation. Boy, was there a Freudian slip there. Sorry about that. The background of the blaxploitation film in relation to this, and you know, did you want to go into that a bit?
Well, there are some touch points and hits about race which are not directly referenced as such. One of the things that you'll notice in the movie is that the only woman to actually have her breast bared is the black woman.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the black men in this movie are overly aggressive and angry. Basically, they're hitting stereotype buttons, which is amazing because for the most part, they avoided them. And then there's this point where Blackenstein seems to attack a lot of people in the midst of being sexually assaulted. There's the date rape guy first. There's the couple who is just having sex. Then there's the date rape. And then there what appears to be just rape. And apparently, Blackenstein is attracted to sex. Yeah, of all the sex scenes that there are, in all these scenes where sex, the date rape scene, and then finally the rape scene, the only one where the woman's best breast are bare is the black woman. And the one where the guy is overly aggressive is, of course, that final rape scene, and he's black. So it's hitting those points, but in other respects, it avoids them completely. Winifred Walker is a physicist, and there's no big deal made about this. Lieutenant Jackson is a lieutenant in the police force. Nothing's made of this. So it's like, hey, look, my people are good too. They have good jobs. They blah, 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 blah. And then we'll put this aggressive, stereotypy scene in. Like, really? Really? But that wasn't the point that made me go really the most, but we'll get into what made me go really the most later.
Okay. I do want to point out that I do think the finale, which features a Doberman attack, is meant to make this film, quote unquote, relevant. And more specifically, I'm wondering if this isn't a reflection on the finale of Night of the Living Dead, which of course, echoed the race issues of that time, but that was like 5 years previous.
They sick the dogs and the black eye.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's not relevant in any way, shape, or form. By not relevant, I mean completely relevant. So, what amazes me about that scene is that he shot at earlier. Earlier in the film, he is shot at. You know what happens when the bullets hit him? Nothing. Just he makes that noise that sounds like he's snoring, like he's asleep at the end. And then, at the end of the film, dogs kill him. Wait a minute. I'm sorry. Where I live, bullets are more powerful than dogs. So I don't know where you live, but where I live, bullets are more powerful than dogs. So I'm like, wait a minute. How does he... The bullets didn't... But the dog... And then my brain exploded, and then I collapsed. And when I woke up, you know, I had to do the show.
I also suspect that there aren't really that many police dogs that are trained to disembowel their target.
Yeah, but this was back in the 1970s was afraid of Dobermans. Dobermans were all powerful. Did you see that Columbo episode?
No, I missed that one.
Well, there's an excellent Columbo episode featuring Dobermans.
What was that Disney movie? Like those amazing Dobermans or...
The Doberman Who Came to Die. I don't know. There were all these Disney films featuring dogs that usually featured a sequence where the dog would wreck a garden party. I do remember
Doberman
that.
Doberman Gang.
That yeah, that's anyway. It. There you go. Okay. There you go. You know, I want to get back to talking about the Stein Clinic or the Stein Institute, because I'm trying to figure out what sort of facility this is. First off, there seem to be only two people there as patients. But they do have comfortable digs. You got to say that. But
they have private rooms.
They have it's wonderful there. It's very nice. You know,
it's a mansion. And he set up his little lab in the basement. And oh, we forgot to mention that he has laser beam fusion machines.
I missed that part.
That's how he grafts things. That's where the zebra leg comes from. I use my laser beam fusion graft.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's his private estate, and he's got his labs there. It's very Victorian.
Wasn't that a Mountain Dew flavor as well, laser beam fusion? I'm not sure. Yeah, but, you know, while we're taking the tour of the Institute, and Andrea, you were right, you know, there is this sequence with Dr. Stein and this woman who's supposed to be 90 years old, and he's using the DNA injections to keep her young. The thing that struck me about that is that there is this sequence where, you know, he's presenting these patients to Winifred, and he's there with the woman. He gives her the shot, and in front of the woman, he says, you know, that without these injections, and here's what he says, is that without these injections, I'm afraid she'll go back to her 90s and much older. And then he says, you go to sleep now. You know, that's a nice say in front of a person. That's bedside manner for you.
Yeah, there are several instances of bedside manner that raise issues here. I mean, I don't know how any of these people were trained when they went to doctor school, but that doctor has conversations about his patients in front of his patients, like, hey, look at this. And Winifred has not yet perfected her doctoral poker face. It's like, and now let me show you what this guy's leg looks like. Oh my God. I'm like, all right, lady, rein it in. Oh yeah. No way to make the guy feel self-conscious. Like your jaw hitting the floor.
But hey, Andrew, at least she emotes.
Well, Yes. You know, in that one instance, she was emoting more than most of the other characters put together. At least during that, you know, she didn't act like she was subdued under an ether rag. but by the way, I do love that setting. The setting is like one of the coolest parts of this movie for me. I want to know where that place is, where they filmed it. But IMDb does not have it listed under filming locations because I want to go there. I want to go explore. It looks so cool. But you can tell that they're actually like spending time, you know, that the outside is that fancy, pretty building, but also inside is either the same or a different fancy, pretty building.
Yeah.
But what a great setup. You know, the patients have private rooms. You also have, you know, the dungeon set up downstairs. That's handy. that should apparently be part of your mansion design.
By the way, you know, Dr. Stein calls it the room next to the lab.
You mean the dungeon next to the lab?
No, he calls it the room.
Yes.
A little bit of euphemism there.
I don't know what they usually use that room for, but...
Well, you know, the guy has to have a personal life, after all.
What's his safe word?
Very nice.
While we're talking Novocaine, let's talk a little bit about Eddie, played by Joe Dessou. By the way, it's his only credit in film.
Get used to hearing that a lot. Go on.
Yes. Poor guy. It's like he doesn't have that.
I'm sorry, Dan. That was the wrong reaction. I should say this. No.
Oh, can't breathe.
Maybe these were all just the directors or the producers' buddies or people he found on the street.
Yeah, it's got to be that, you know. It was like maybe he was a delivery guy or something, you know. It's like, we need...
That would make more sense.
You're black, you'll do, come on in.
Look, if that guy auditioned for that role and won the role, I want to see who failed the audition. And did that person emote less?
Is it possible to emote less?
I don't know. I don't know.
Poor guy. And his first line, by the way, is, "Can I have some ice cream?" And, you know, that pretty much dooms him from the first.
He was one of a series of actors who I believe could not act their way out of a wet paper bag.
And by the way, you know, you were talking about her reaction to Bruno's leg, and as I mentioned before, there is a quick shot of Bruno's leg, and he's got, and it's sort of hard to see, but I do believe he's got a tiger's leg or tiger fur, or something like.
I think they just painted tiger stripes on his leg.
On his leg,
yes, they did
something like that. So. You know, and what I love about that is the idea that probably in the pitch for this film, there was going to be, see the sequence where he fights the half man, half tiger. God. And it sort of worked out to 7/8 man, 1/8 tiger, as it actually worked out in the film. So now, Andrea, I know you were champing at the bit to talk about this, so let's talk a little bit about the music, because
this
is particularly inspirational in this film. Do you wanna?
Well, you can call it inspirational. I can call it ridiculous. Now, I know that some of you picked up on something that I did not pick up on, so we will get to that in a sec. But my main entertainment value was like the shifting styles of music, and like sometimes it would be clearly music that they either bought or, you know, was specifically recorded for the film, and then they'd be like, and now we're going to put in some classical music, and now we're going to put in some blues music, and now we're going to put in whatever we happen to have on this tape recorder, and it would sort of go back and forth, and sometimes the music would be really extremely dramatic when nothing dramatic was happening. Yeah, you're like, what?
The music works harder than anybody else in this film. There are literally scenes where there's just a person sitting there and the music is going, da 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 da.
And you're like, what? What? Is there subtext? What's going on? She's sitting in a chair. What? What's funny is that I was watching it on Netflix with the captions on, which helped me when people were mumbling their dialogue. But the Netflix captions are also fun because they'll tell you, like, okay, some music is playing, and so they'll just sort of give you an idea of what kind of music is playing in case you can't hear it. It included an assortment of one of my personal favorites, laid-back bluesy music, pensive music, sinister music, tense music, dramatic percussive music, and heartening music. Those all entertained me a lot, and I'd be like, wait, what's going on? And sometimes the music would shift in the middle of a scene, and I'm like, okay, wait, what's happening now? And then there is also, I must mention, there is a musical number in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Not since the epic Hanging Out With My Family in Birdemic have we seen such an unnecessary musical number in a horror movie. And I'm like, wait, are there people still getting killed outside? Why is there suddenly a musical number? Like, what's going on? I was like, oh, did you realize it was too short? Or because she sung in the opening credits, she said, no, I want to appear on film as myself. So they did that. And it just kind of like went back and forth with, you know, with the music. So it's like, okay, so now it's like, hi, we're going to take a break from all this scary stuff out that's going on outside. And we're going to have a musical number, and oh, we're going to have a stand-up comedy number that will stay with you for years to come.
By the way, in all that closed captioning, there wasn't any subtitle for Viennese Waltz, because they relied on that a lot.
No, it would never really get that specific, but sometimes it would just be, you know, they would just kind of say, you know, like fast music or, you know, tense music or uplifting music. But there was something that you and Kevin picked up on that I totally missed out on.
Yeah, and Kevin, you and I sort of wrestled about who was going to talk about this, but I'm going to defer to you. This moment, by the way, filled me with delight.
I think this gives us some hidden insight into how the music was chosen. I think somebody was sent to a music library and just told, get me some classical music. So there's a wonderful scene in a park with a young couple, and the guy's sort of putting the moves on this young lady, and boy, is he smooth. I like your hair. Do you like to have it touched? She's like, no, I don't, you creep. But he pops in a beautiful white 8-track tape. And you just hear it. This is his smooth operator music. It is this sort of classical music, and you can't quite tell what it is at first. But then later on, as the conversation progresses, you're like, that's vaguely familiar. Is that a Christmas carol? And then as you're just about to get out of the car, you can clearly hear the strains of my favorite song of seduction, Good King Wenceslas.
See, the fact that you were even able to focus on that is, like, hilarious. Because I was too fixated on, oh, wait a minute. This is, like, 2 minutes away from an attempted date rape. Like, thank you, movie. And by the way, one of several attempted rape scenes in this movie. Thank you, movie. But I was just like, but I was paying attention when he first started playing the music that it was totally inappropriate for makeout music. It was very quick, fast-paced, uplifting classical music. I'm like, oh, this is what you put on to make out? But
You need Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
I totally missed the part where it fused into Christmas music.
Well, you know, this conversation is making me so very hot right now because of all the Christmas music. So, you know, it must be effective.
Down, boy. Down, kid. Take a shower. Throw a towel over it, Chucko.
I will say that musical number and the accompanying nightclub act with it, that at least seems to be slightly blaxploitation because it's a scene of urban activity and life. I don't want to get too pedantic about it, but nothing else in this film is sort of urban and contemporary. The rest of it, you know, almost literally could be set in 1800s Germany or Switzerland or something like that. There's not a whole, you know, somebody could have lost their limbs in a war, in a Crimea. I mean, there's nothing, well, there's lasers. Okay, and there's DNA. Okay, aside from that.
Well, you know, it sort of felt to me like they said, holy shit, this is a blaxploitation film. We better get some blaxploitation stuff in there. And so it's like they crammed everything into this nightclub. You got your Superflies in there. I think Shaft is in there. You got your blues singer. You got your Red Fox comedian. Yeah. It's all in that one scene.
No, wait a minute. There are several blaxploitation things that we haven't touched on, and one of which is the racist white orderly that he has to deal with. And that guy, meanwhile, huge jerk, meanwhile, one of the better actors in this film, who actually had multiple IMDb credits as opposed to one.
Yes.
They tried to give him depth, too. He was more complicated than simply just being a straight bigot. He had this whole backstory. And then they dropped all of that.
It was very confusing because they're like, this guy, we would like to present to you as a jerk. This guy is a huge jerk. We are putting a target on his forehead because we know that when things go down, that this guy is going to get killed and you guys are going to feel happy about it. Oh, wait, he's actually a human being who has regrets and who has issues and who's fully fleshed out. Nah, we're going to kill him anyway.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that he actually wrote his own role.
Hey, could have been. You know. I mean, look, his lines were better written and had more depth than most of the script. So, you know, perhaps he was the person who did it. But look, I mean, between that and, I haven't seen that many blaxploitation films other than Blackula, near and dear to my heart. But look, there is that whole scene that takes place in the nightclub, you know, with the singer, with the comedian. And then, those shots of the audience. Oh, my God. I mean, I'm sorry. Did everyone dress this way in 1970?
Or did
they have a special discount at that club where pimps got in for free?
Three pimps in matching red suits. That's an awesome shot.
Yeah. Every time they cut to those guys, I'm like, oh my God, what is that?
I need a moment of clarification here. Without actually telling the joke, because it's such a great joke.
Yeah.
I just want to know, I don't think I quite have the punchline. Did the thing in question get a hooker? Is that the punchline?
The answer, yeah.
Okay, just checking. Yeah. Sure.
That's the gist of it. I've heard that joke before. It's a joke about a talking dog. We'll tell you that much. I've heard that joke that began that way before, but it never ended quite that crudely. I'll say that.
Can I bring up something that really, really bothered me? Like a million things bothered me in this movie, but something that really, really bothered me, and I'm not sure it bothered anybody else. After Eddie gets the sabotage treatment and he mutates into something else, now Eddie has lost the use of his limbs. Actually, Eddie doesn't have limbs. His limbs, at one point, Winfred remarks that he lost his limbs in Vietnam. They've been blown off. He has no limbs. When we first see Blackenstein, Eddie gets out of the bed and his limbs have reformed. He's wearing a sport jacket, a turtleneck, and slacks. At no point did his clothes ever put on him. So apparently DNA not only mutates you into some large-headed creature who walks really slowly, sounds like makes sleep apnea noises, but it also dresses you.
Hawk, you left out a major clothing component. He's fully dressed, including new shiny boots.
How did this happen?
Did the doctor and Winifred, heal him, transplant on the arms and legs, and they left him in his bed, fully dressed, including the shiny boots? Like, why? For giggles? For entertainment? Because they thought it would look cute?
You know, I always sleep in my sport coat, turtleneck, slacks, and big new shiny boots.
Well, because clearly he can't bend down to put boots on. He can't even lean over to do anything. He's walking like Frankenstein.
Well, let me talk about the walking.
Oh, boy.
There's a lot of walking. He walks everywhere. But he's not a very frightening walking creature because, I'll be honest, I am perfectly middle-aged. I don't run really fast right now. I could lap him on a track. I could just run around the track, come back, hi, Eddie, and just keep going around, hi, Eddie, and just keep passing him repeatedly. I'm like, why are you so scared of him? Just run. Just keep running. He won't catch you. I'm still trying to figure out why all of these people end up dead at his hands, because really, you just have to run. As long as you don't stand there and scream, you've got a good shot of getting away.
Well, you see, most of those people die because they throw themselves at him.
Yeah, Hawk, there's several pieces of you know, horror movie logic, or horror movie tropes, if you will. And one is that if a slow-moving monster is going after you, the slow-moving monster will be able to catch you through whatever accident or, you know, circumstance, or you fall in a, you know, pothole and twist your ankle, or you're too busy having sex or thinking about having sex or having just had sex. And also, if you're sexually active, you're more likely to be attacked by a monster, because that'll happen.
The thing is, and this goes back to what you were saying, Hawk, about, you know, him getting dressed with the DNA treatments, is that I had some doubts about this myself, because it could be a linguistic thing, and I wasn't sure exactly what Winifred said. If she had said he lost his limbs in Vietnam, could mean the limbs got blown off, or that he lost control, or was it specifically said that he actually got his limbs blown off? Does anybody remember?
I remember her specifically saying it, and also it's symbolic, because with the first death committed by Blackenstein, what does he do to the orderly?
Well, I know what was supposed to be suggested. What it looked like to me was that he was bouncing the guy back and forth, and then somebody handed him a prosthetic arm.
Well, that's the fun of attacking somebody behind a curtain. You know, so there's an extra layer of nuance there. No, okay. I will tell you that what they officially say in the plot is that he lost his arms and his legs because of a landmine in Vietnam, which begs the question, was he playing leapfrog? How do you lose your arms and your legs, but the rest of you is fine?
Yeah.
But whatever. Perhaps I was overthinking this. However, if you look really carefully, by which I mean not carefully at all, there is the scene where the ambulance people.
Yeah, this was the one I was
taking him out of the ambulance and bringing him into the undisclosed mansion. And you clearly see his footies. So everything's still there and fine and attached. They couldn't even tell him to, I don't know, hide his feet in something, point his toes down, anything? Whatever.
Why, one might think they weren't trying very hard in this movie.
Mwaha.
Does anybody want to bring up anything else about Blackenstein?
Oh, there's so much.
I have lots of issues with the science. Oh, I also have issues with the tagline.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, we'll get to that in a sec. But Andrea, bring up like a couple of issues.
The science, the tagline.
Yeah, the science.
Okay. Well, I mean, the science. Now, maybe it might have to do with the fact that they were using scientific equipment from the original Frankenstein movie from the 1930s. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're using still the Jacob's ladder and the Van der Graaff generator and whatever, you're like, wait, what is this doing? How are these sparks flying? What does this have to do with anything? There are the issues about where the arms and legs came from. It was very unclear for most of the movie about, did they come from cadavers? Were they grown somewhere? Did the doctor just have a barrel of spare parts lying around? But later in the movie, they do make a reference to transplant parts. So there's that. I mean, I guess it's, you know, a big part of it just has to do with logic, you know, or lack thereof. I mean, the monster goes on killing sprees several nights in a row. No one even notices he's left his room, right? Doesn't he have blood under his fingernails, on his clothes? Shouldn't he smell like dead people? Nobody even notices. He does it multiple nights. Why is the monster obsessed with the intestines of his pretty female victims? Doesn't do that to men. So I have that issue. I do have the issue about, you know, the logic of fists can't hurt you, bullets can't hurt you, but a couple of dogs can. Still very confused about that. You know, all the DNA and RNA in those, you know, in those hydrogen peroxide bottles that you just wrote on something with a magic marker.
And by the way, you just put the name Eddie. Eddie DNA.
Yeah, that's it. Eddie DNA. It's just, you know, and you can transfer stuff back and forth to beakers. There are lots of beakers, lots of bubbling beakers, because that's also very 1930s science kind of thing. I mean, it's, I don't know. There are so many, you know, sort of scientific things that you go, wait a minute. I don't think that's how that would work.
By the way, all that electronic equipment dates back to the original Universal Frankenstein movies. Those were all owned by this guy, Ken Strickfaden, who I think at that point was pretty much just renting them out to bar mitzvahs and weddings at that point. But but he had all this stuff and he was making his living, particularly at that time, renting that equipment out for the various Frankenstein knockoffs.
Yeah, I mean, so you sort of see like, oh, that's nice, that's sort of an homage. But like, it's like 5% of the time you could tell that the filmmakers were sort of trying to do something artsy or something interesting or something elevated. But then the other 95% of the time it was just so stupid. And I'm like, wait, the DNA, the genetic code, the RNA, she gets injections every 12 hours, then you inject this guy, then he has a tiger leg. What? I'm like, it's like I spent 95% of this movie going, what's going on?
Hawk, anything else you wanted to bring up?
Well, you mentioned this before. Is Malcolm the butler or the lab assistant? Because at some point he's wearing a butler's coat. At some point he's wearing a lab coat. And I have never heard a worse profession of love in my entire life. Winifred, I love you. And I'm like, what? What? Dude, if you do love her, you can say it a lot better than that. And how did he fall in love with her? They barely had a conversation. But he falls in love with her and decides, you know what? The way to win her love is to sabotage the treatment of her boyfriend. By the way, excuse me, her fiancé. The fiancé that she's sticking with after having his limbs blown off. What are you going to do that's going to make her stop loving him? There isn't anything at that point. At that point, you just have to give up and go, I'm done. What am I going to do? But instead, he sabotages it, and then he gets killed by the monster. So in essence, he commits suicide. The most longest, complicated suicide in the world. But yet, he commits suicide.
By the way, I at least give him credit for not throwing the gun at Eddie after it doesn't work on him. He at least had that amount of restraint. Kevin, how about you? Anything further?
A couple things. Andrea pointed out, yeah, there are one or two nice shots, artistic shots in this movie. There's one really great German expressionist kind of use of shadow as Blackenstein is stalking around. It looks really great. Yeah. Did anybody else find the laboratory, which was sort of strewn haphazardly with all that great equipment? This is so bizarre, but I swear it's true. It reminded me of the set of It's a Small World.
What?
Not a bad comparison there, actually.
When you go through It's a Small World, there would just be here is an Alp with a goat over here. Here is, you know, a Mexican sunrise. And the placement of things in the lab just reminded me of that sort of haphazard, not quite too high, not quite too low. Go back and watch it again, and in your mind, hum, It's a Small World, and see if it works for you.
It's very
disconcerting.
You know what it is, and I think what's doing it for you is that if you go through It's a Small World, you notice they have all the stuff strewn there. But in the background, there's nothing. There's in film terms, just a blank backdrop is called a psych, short for cyclorama. And that's all there is in the lab. If you notice in the back of the lab, there's no details to the wall. It's just a white psych. And actually, if you look very closely in at least one shot, you can actually see the top of the set.
So the things in the front are moving and generating sparks and things like that, but the background is flat.
And actually, it's sort of a curved sort of thing. That's where you get the cyclorama from. It's just most to create sort of an image of limitless space, that there is actually no background. But that's, I think, what's doing that for you. But, you know, the thing – I'm sorry, Kevin, go.
No, great. I'm glad to know that. Yeah, now that I think about it more and more,
But, you know, you did bring up the thing about the photography of this, and I do want to salute Robert Caramico, who was the director of photography on this, because apparently while everything else was getting more and more slipshod in the film, Robert appeared to be getting more ambitious as things went along. So, yeah, there are a lot of German expressionist shots with the monster's shadow on the back wall, and there's like a low angle shot where one of the victims runs away, and it's angled through the sunglasses that she drops.
Yeah, that was very cool.
Onto the ground, and there's like another thing where he does like a handheld track back onto a crane that goes up. So that was fantastic. And so, you know, I say, you know, and by the way, he did go on to actually a fruitful career afterwards. So I want to say, you know, great for you, Robert. You really did a bang up job. If only you had spent just a few more seconds looking through the lens of the camera so you could have caught the moment when Winifred takes directly to the lens. I didn't miss that. Did you miss that? It's one of the sequences where she's tending to Eddie in the dungeon, and she comes out of the cell, and as she's walking out, boom, she stares directly into the camera. How am I doing?
Yeah. Wow. Like surprise squirrel on YouTube.
Ha! Oops.
Huh? So, shall we go on to talk about what we learned from this movie?
Wait, I have to ask the question to the group about the tagline.
Oh, okay.
The tagline to this movie, according to IMDb and according to the box art, is, ready, "To stop this mother takes one bad brother." MUTHABRUTHA. Okay, so let's get beyond the issues I have with the spelling and with the grammar. Whom exactly are we speaking of?
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
Who's stopping? Who? What? Are we talking about the cop with the good hair? Who are we talking about? I'm very confused.
Yeah.
He gets stopped by dogs that no one else stops. He gets stopped by... So we have a bad mother. We have Eddie as Blackenstein. We don't have the brother to stop him. We don't...
I'm very confused.
Presuming that Eddie is the mother, it might be Winifred who's the mother.
Wait a minute.
No, maybe
mother is Malcolm with a B, and then the brother is the monster. So I'm totally confused by this. Anyway, I just had to throw that out.
It goes back to the entire thing of this movie giving you questions or presenting half of a story and then go, oh, payoff? You don't need a payoff.
Yes, lots of questions without answers. Like, hey, the DNA formula just isn't taking hold and we must work on a locking feature. wait, what? What?
So shall we talk about what we learned from this movie?
Yes.
Okay, so Andrea, I think we'll start with you and then go around Kevin and Hawk and then me. Andrea, what did you learn from Blackenstein?
You can always set your guests at ease by inviting them to sit on a one-person bench directly next to a huge statue of the Virgin Mary.
Kevin?
I learned that nothing brings the ladies like the Bing Crosby Christmas album.
Hawk?
I learned science!
I learned there's no external difference between a VA hospital and a grain processing plant.
I learned that if you mix up your DNA and RNA formulas, you're likely to develop a bad case of tiger leg.
I learned that it's a fine line between Blankenstein and a Klingon. Cranial ridges.
There you go.
I learned that you could be a geneticist and win the Nobel Peace Prize for genetics.
Sterilizing serums is just a formality.
Ha. I've learned that medical doctors always need to keep straitjackets lying around.
I learned that if you give a dog $5, he's just going to blow it on hookers.
I learned that if you discover the secrets of preventing aging in the 1970s, you don't sell it and become a billionaire. You just keep it to yourself and hide the woman in question in a room in your mansion.
Out of sheer terror, people will walk into the death grip of a monster.
I've learned that every doctor's mansion should have a dungeon with a heavy metal gate, chains that are close enough to that gate to make beating the patients easier, and one tiny lamp to ensure dramatic lighting.
I'm out.
Hawk?
I've learned that if you change DNA formulas, if you change DNA formulas, there's no way that can go wrong.
When there's a homicidal mutant on the loose, it is not advisable to leave your crate of 4th of July fireworks in the middle of the laboratory floor.
To build dramatic tension, make sure that you have several scenes in which you show your monster walking slowly across a large room.
Butler, lab assistant, all the same thing.
You can test the efficacy of DNA by smell.
If you want to set the mood for a romantic makeout session, live classical music is not going to do the trick.
Dogs can kill a bulletproof monster.
Restoring control to a patient's four limbs is a process best done in 3 steps.
All right. Well, Hawk just took one of mine, so that means I have one left. It's best to store DNA in an old hydrogen peroxide bottle.
I'm out.
Okay, I've got 2 more. Nelson's a chump. And to paraphrase the closing title from the classic Universal Monster movies, a bad cast is worth deleting.
Ha!
And let's move on to our drinking game. Andrea, start us off.
Take a drink every time someone sounds like they're reading off of a script.
Take a drink every time somebody injects somebody.
Take a drink every time you hear the words Dr. Winifred Walker.
Every time the music cuts off abruptly, take a drink.
On a related note, take a drink every time the musical style changes.
take a drink every time you see somebody carrying a covered tray.
Ooh.
Take a drink every time you see Blackenstein walking.
Every time the cameraman thinks he's Carl Freund, take a drink.
Take a drink every time you question the scientific accuracy of this movie.
Alcohol poisoning right there.
Every time you see a piece of out-of-place statuary, take a drink.
Take a drink every time someone emotes. Oh, wait, you'll never drink then.
Every time it's clear that Ken Strickfaden got paid more than anybody else on the film, take a drink.
Take a drink every time you think that a line or an action is setting you up for a payoff later in the movie, which never actually happens.
Very good. That's my last one. I don't know if this is related to Dan's or not, but take a drink every time there is a use of the fisheye lens. I'm out.
Take a drink every time the dubbing has just got awful.
Every time you see the top of a set, take a drink.
I have one left. Take a drink every time you see a Jacob's ladder, a Van de Graaff generator, or some other form of electrical equipment in action.
Okay, once again, alcohol poisoning.
I'm out.
Okay, I've got one more. For every person for whom Blackenstein was their first and last film, donate $10 to the SAG Disaster Fund.
Aw.
And that'll be it for Blackenstein, and thank goodness. So, you know, Hawk, since you are our new regular, I think you should have the honor of picking the next film. Have you chosen a film for the next show?
Oh, you're going to love this.
Uh-oh.
Superhero Damon, who rides a robotic motorcycle that knows karate, is called upon to battle the Syndicate Sigma, led by the evil Dr. Akiyomoya, and his psychic, gorgeous cyborg Miss Ward. Karate Robo Zaborga.
Wow, that sounds great. Now, could you repeat the synopsis in English?
We're going to be watching a Japanese robot karate motorcycle movie, Karate Robo Zaborga.
Cool. Have we done a Japanese? I don't think we've actually done a Japanese. We've done Korean.
Ricky. A Korean.
And oh, the Chinese? Wait.
And Chinese. We did...
what was the Mighty Peking Man?
That was Peking, Chinese.
Was that? Yeah, that's Chinese. Okay, yeah. So, there you go.
For anybody... Sorry?
No, go ahead, Paul.
For anybody who wants to know more about this film... Cracked.com recently did an article on this puppy. Well, did an article on several weird-ass films, and this was one of them. And they include a brief clip of cybernetic sex. It will short-circuit your brain. So, yeah.
There's cybernetic sex in this film?
Yes.
I'm in.
Oh no. You're not. You'll just walk away horrified. But that's not actual. What? Yes, you'll do that.
Okay. Andrea, before we go, do you want to bring people up to date on what's going on with BeABetterBookTalker.com?
Sure. Please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Check out the website at BeABetterBookTalker.com. When I'm not over here talking about lousy movies, I'm over there talking about good books. Comes out once a week, and you'll get lots of recommendations for great books for kids and teens.
You achieve a balance that way, Andrea.
Yeah, well, between, my good books over there, my bad movies over here, and my occasional good movie appearances on Cine Fantastique, I'm a Renaissance woman. How about that?
Hey, okay. Kevin, what's going on over at Chronic Rift and with your own blog?
The blog is kevinlauderdale.livejournal.com, and it's got various pop culture and non-pop culture musings. But mostly I posted that, I've just done that podcast for the Chronic Rift. Once a month, approximately, if you subscribe to all the Chronic Rift podcasts, you can get my other one, which is It Has Come to My Attention. And I talk for 5 or 10 minutes about just quick things that have come to my attention, movies, films, books, you should be sure and check out.
Okay. Yep. And Hawk, what's going on over at multimediumrare.com?
Well, I have been talking about my journey to healing from... I am a widower, and I'm talking about my journey to healing a lot. As things get better, and the open healing seems to take hold, I'm writing about happier things. So look for some more weird and unusual pop culture musings forthcoming.
Cool. Okay. And let me just remind everybody about the Kickstarter campaign for Inside the Fantastic. We really do need your help to get this show going. So go to Kickstarter, do a search on Cinefantastique, and you'll get the campaign that way. Or you can go to the posting for this episode of Temple of Bad over at CFQOnline.com. or MightyMoviePodcast.com, and we'll have links up there as well. We got t-shirts. We've got rare issues of magazines. We've got an opportunity for you to be an executive producer for an episode of the show. How can you turn that away?
Everybody chips in and funds it, then I am going to get my t-shirt rewards.
Yes, that's right. So,
chip in and fund it. I want to look stylish, damn it.
And that'll be it for the show. Andrea Lipinski, thank you for joining us.
It is always a hoot, Dan.
Kevin Lauderdale, thank you.
Frankenstein. Yeah, I used to date his sister, Phyllis.
What's up, Marine? Okay, and Orenthal Hawkins, glad to have you on as a regular.
I'm quite happy to be a regular, although I may rethink the decision in the next 10 years.
Remember, it was your call on this one.
Yes, I know.
And I'm Dan Persons. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And remember, until next time, may a bad film be the worst thing to happen to you. You've got forsaken. And you've got forsaken. And you've got forsaken. God was sleeping.